mean, you want one?
I know.
So two clicks?
Yeah. All right. I want to calm to mind and.
Yeah.
Yeah. Calm and worry and anxiety.
Take credit for that.
Well, I do want to tell you again about a very special event at St. Thomas this coming Tuesday night at 7:30. There is a colleague of mine, Kenneth Kemp, will be speaking on evolution and Catholic thought. Kemp is retiring because he's gone deaf. But you'll be able to ask questions on file cards, and he can read those. But he has done some of the most important work internationally on evolution and Catholic thought, in particular on the evolution, how evolution and the Catholic Church have tried to square the circle of evolution and Adam and Eve.
Do you know what building he will be in?
I do. I'll write it here. And maybe, I don't know if Jessica's going to be back, if we can send everybody an email, but I'll write the information here.
We saw that one about to happen. That would have been one of those mistakes. Anderson Center?
Yeah.
Or is Anderson the old Murray Hall?
Anderson's the new building.
The new building.
It's right on the corner of Creighton and Summit.
Where the tennis court is. Corner of Creighton and Summit.
It's very much
near
your building, right?
Where the parking lot is.
No, it's on the main St.
Yeah, the parking lot's by the tennis courts.
Okay.
And then the parking is, it's just about a 3 to 5 minute walk from the parking ramp to the building. So
I wonder if anybody would drive from here if enough people wanted to go.
I can talk to Jessica about which day is it? Next Tuesday?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That May
1st?
The
30th?
No.
30th. Tuesday.
Kemp is an interesting fellow. He was in he was in military intelligence many years ago, and speaks I don't know how many languages and writes them all. He especially was good at all the Eastern European languages and was very useful, I think, that way. So he's had really interesting career. And but his work in evolution has included trips to the Vatican, where he's had access to some of the Vatican files on people like Teilhard de Chardin and that. So do come to it if you can. And then we'll have our final session a week from today on Wednesday. All right, so here's theodicy. And there are really two traditional theodicies in philosophy, but those are okay, and we'll run through those quickly, but the third one is the one I'm most interested in, and it's not really a theodicy, but it answers the question. Well, let's go back first to the free process. The free process defense of God says that nature has to be lawful. So you must have you can't interfere with the process every time something bad's going to happen. So every time a five-year-old child is about to fall off a little ledge he's walking on and scrape his knee, if some angel swoops down and gives the child a soft landing, the child will never learn the value of height. We learn from the unyielding laws that are there. Gravity never takes a break. And if it did, if one of us got lucky every now and then, we'd just stop learning. We'd just get lazy. Now, let's talk about earthquakes. In 1755, there was a horrendous earthquake in Lisbon, Portugal. I think over 50,000 people died, men, women, and children. It was ugly. The city was pretty much destroyed. Europe was horrified at the loss of life. And this started the issue of theodicy as a question in theology. Well, something interesting happened after that. The elders of the city got together after it had been destroyed, and they actually talked about re-engineering their new building so that it would withstand future quakes. And they, for the first time, started to ask, what causes the quake? And some of them guessed there was some kind of movement. They didn't know about tectonic plates, of course, at that time. But they later figured it out. This was a scientific development. This is a response. This is like the parable of the talents again. You can't get the people who are killed in Lisbon back. You know, they're dead, they're gone, the tragedy's there, the suffering's there. But by studying the tragedy, you can prevent future tragedy. And that's what we do. We sometimes can't help what's already happened, but we can help the future. So, 1989, I think it was the second game of the World Series in San Francisco. They were playing Oakland. So it was all West Coast right there. There was an earthquake of, I think it was 7.1 on the Richter scale. They had to call the game off. And 62 people over the whole Bay Area of California died. Now that's a lot of people dying, 62. But it could have been, it very easily could have been 6 million with all those bridges and buildings but what had they done? They had engineered the bridges. They'd engineered the buildings, even the stadiums, so that they wouldn't collapse, so that it wouldn't just be a repeat of what happened in 1755. It worked. It's human cultural progress. So you can also remember an earthquake, a terrible earthquake about that time, not around that time, in Haiti. That was absolutely devastating. Somewhere, the numbers are all different, but something like 200,000 or 300,000 died. The earthquake in Haiti was actually slightly less than the San Francisco Oakland earthquake in the World Series. So how do you respond to the struggle, pain, and death that nature sometimes serves up? With logos, with intelligent effort and community effort to make human life better. It's part of our job. It's an unfinished creation. Yes, Nelson.
Another indicator of that is when you look at hurricanes in the United States, it used to be that when hurricanes would come, like Galveston or other places back in the early part of the century, the damages and the losses were stated in terms of human life. They're now stated in terms of billions of dollars, because the weather prediction has gotten so much better and the infrastructure of support has gotten so much better since that time. It's shifted now from loss of life to loss of property value.
Excellent, really, really excellent point. I mean, billions of dollars is still bad, Loss of property, bad. Loss of life, worse. Because we treasure life. We know we can't ultimately, well, we can't defeat death in one sense, but in another sense, I think we can, because we get help. So, you remember the black boxes on the airplanes that, well, when I was a boy, there were always lots of airplane crashes. You know, my father would take me on trips, you know, when they first started flying with these twin props, you know, and I was always terrified. And he'd say, "Isn't this great?" And I'd say, "Yes, damn it." But I remember these guys would come on the radio and say, well, they'd have that radio voice, you know, and they'd say, "A plane has gone down in northern Indiana. All aboard are feared lost. But members of the Federal Aviation Association are on the scene looking for the black box." And I thought, now, how's that going to help anybody? They're all dead. Everybody's grieving. How's that going to help? But it helps. How does it help? How did finding the black box help? Let me ask you.
Data.
Yeah? Data. We got the data from what happened, the final records of the electronic records and the voices in the cockpit. And then how did that help?
Prevents
the future ones. It can't help the ones that are dead. But it's so safe to fly now because of the black box that these guys found and worked on. And they looked at the failure. Looking at failure, what a great lesson that is for us guys. So every Sunday we say, "Lord, I'm not worthy that you should enter under my roof," right before we take communion. So we look at the failure. There's a great value in honestly looking at failure. So that's the free process. It says that it's a teaching mechanism. Now imagine this. Imagine a scenario where every time a disaster is about to strike, there's an interference, so we would never feel pain. But because the motivation to understand nature's law is removed, the cost would be enormous. If you take away the teaching mechanism of pain, that alters the very nature of reality. And the meaning of our most basic understandings and even our words just are nullified. So if you touch a fire and you're not getting burned, what does heat mean? If you fall and it doesn't mean anything, what does it mean to be level or vertical or up or down? Even our words, our whole orientation is gone. Human life is gone. Pain is a teaching mechanism. So we can dream of a softer, kinder world, but the price of having that world would be disastrous. So that's my first answer in the free process. Let's go to the free will defense of God in this kind of evolutionary creation. Well, nature is largely governed by necessity, but human persons are governed by thinking and choosing, as well as necessity. So we have to learn to be self-governing, and that process is a lifelong process, and it doesn't always go that well. Referred to earlier remarks about not being worthy. So free will can turn to good, and it also can turn to evil. Now, pain and suffering are greatly intensified when another person or a group of persons freely and deliberately inflicts harm on us. When something in nature harms us, we feel physical pain. But when another person harms us, physical pain is magnified by moral shock. We're shocked that somebody would be evil and would hurt us. Every time that happens, and we've all experienced this, it's just shocking. It's like looking at evil like it's just such a strange phenomenon. And yet, if we didn't have free will, we would never have anything known as love. There'd be no point to our humanity without that freedom. So whatever the cost is, we got to have it. You cannot, whatever the cost is, it's still worth it. That's my answer to the second part. Even, now we can certainly hope to diminish it. And that's what evangelism is. That's what raising children in the church is. It's trying to teach them that there are higher, greater, solemn reasons for avoiding evil and trying to do good. But the best theodicy, the best defense of the righteousness of God in spite of all the pain and suffering, is really the cross of Christ. Now, you all know the fundamental reason for the cross. So that's the obvious, that Jesus comes to save us. Jesus comes so that we might have eternal life, and he's willing to die to give it for us. But think about all the other things that Jesus' death did. So there's some non-obvious things. So as he's being nailed, he says, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." So he forgives the very people that are doing a rather horrendous start to a torture procedure. He forgives them. What a magnificent lesson for the whole human race. As he's on the cross, he looks all out and he sees his mother and the Apostle John, and he essentially makes something like a social security arrangement for her. They don't have anything like that. He makes an arrangement for his about-to-be-bereft mother. He's thinking about her. The guy on the cross next to him, you know, there's one of the guys is making fun of him, as are many of the people there. The other fellow tells the guy that's making fun of him, basically says, "Why don't you shut up? This guy, we deserve being here, and you know it. This guy is innocent." And then he says to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus looks at this thief on the cross and he says to him, "You're going to sup with me in heaven." So, pretty good tally so far. Great teaching on forgiveness. Takes care of mom. Saves the guy dying on the cross next to him. When it's all over, the Roman centurion slams his breastplate, looks at the guy, and he says, he's never seen anybody die like this. He's seen a lot of guys die. He's killed a lot of guys. He probably was the guy who drove the spikes. And he said, "That was the Son of God." He's even converted the guy who was there to execute him. What a day's work. Well, that's the theodicy. So, when you see Jesus die on the cross, and you start thinking about your own pain and suffering, and how rough and unfair things have been in your life, and they probably have, to some degree or another, you might just take one more look at Jesus and you say, "If he could do that, I can do this." And there's one other thing. We always avoid suffering, we always avoid pain, and we always avoid death for as long as we possibly reasonably can. But when we have to suffer, when we have to experience pain, or when we must die, we can do it the way the way Jesus did it. We can do it with the dignity of a son or daughter of God. And in that sense, even our suffering and pain for a Christian, it's almost a kind of communion, like where Jesus in one of the Gospels says, "Do this in remembrance of me." So if you must suffer, don't do it alone. Do it with Christ. Anyway, those are my thoughts for the evening. And we've got a few minutes. Let's take some of your thoughts and your questions to each other and to me. Yes.
One of the other thoughts I thought about when he died, he also went to Sheol and brought all of them out of Sheol that were good people. So everyone that had died up until that point, and they were waiting for that moment, were saved and brought to heaven.
Well, yes, I think you can always count on God to be fair. Say, well, what about these, whatever, there's all kinds of things we don't know and we can't possibly know. But the one thing I do know is that I've met people who were fair before in the way they handled things, even difficult decisions, but they weren't perfect. But I expect God to have perfect fairness. I think that's the one just judge we can really count on. Any other thoughts or questions or things that are just there? Well then, why don't we call it a night, and we'll see you next week for our final session.